Hi guys, I'm Nana Al-Hagbali and this is Something to Consider. There's a voice inside many of us, a voice that whispers rules about what we can eat, how we should look, who we need to become in order to be enough. And for some, that voice gets louder. It starts to take over. It disguises itself as discipline, control, even success. Until one day we realize we're no longer making choices. We're following orders from a part of ourselves we don't even recognize anymore. In this episode, I speak with Arwa, an intuitive eating coach and certified eating disorder recovery coach, trained through the Carolyn Costin Institute, about that very voice. And the one we often forget we have, the healthy self, the well self. We talk about the journey back to body trust, the lies diet culture has sold us, and the courage it takes to heal. Truly heal, especially in cultures that silence or shame this kind of struggle. What does it look like to stop outsourcing your worth and start living from a place of wholeness? This conversation is about food, yes, but it's also about power. It's about perspective. And it's about the parts of ourselves we pushed away just to survive. And it's a reminder that recovery isn't a one-time event. It's a quiet daily decision. To come home to yourself. Arwa, thank you for being here and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to have this chat with you, Dana.
It's been a while, a long time coming,
yes,
I feel,
exactly.
Right? Arwa and I have been friends for a while, and I have such a profound respect for what you do. I've been following your content for a while. Your content is primarily in Arabic, so I very much appreciate that you decided to pivot today and cater to my English-speaking or majority English-speaking audience.
It's a pleasure.
The first question I usually go with is I leave it to my guest to set the stage for this conversation. So if I were to ask you, if you wanted to give us the context of your background, what do you want us to know to set the stage for the conversation we're about to have about you?
So about me in the context of what we're going to be talking about today, I started out not in this field at all, but one thing leads to another. And it's not planned. It's just like you stumble upon one thing and then that leads you into another. And then, you know, that's how I guess I progressed. So I was interested in the culinary side, nutrition side, and I love cooking and baking in general. And then that brought me into being interested in becoming a health coach. But when I became a health coach, I just felt that I just couldn't do the traditional diet culture type of coaching. And I've, you know, somewhat been an intuitive eater. I was already like versed in intuitive eating, but I dove into it as a coach, not as, you know, a person who was following, let's say, the principles. And it was different diving into it as a coach and being certified in it. I learned so many different things. I looked at things in a different way. And then that, let's say, open the door to eating disorders, because once you start coaching people that have a disordered relationship with food, it's a spectrum. So they could have a normal relationship with food, but they're influenced by diet culture and that's what's draining them. Or they can be at the other end of the spectrum where it's a diagnosable eating disorder or a mental illness in the end. And that's where I found that I needed the extra training in order to help people, no matter where they might fall on this spectrum of disordered eating.
It's interesting how life lends itself to the pivots that we make when it comes to our career. I think it's worth mentioning you are an entrepreneur. And as you said, you do have a dessert brand.
Yes.
It's a bakery called Crumbs.
Yes.
Amazing brand.
Thank
I love
you.
Your products. But what I find interesting is the relationship between developing a brand that is, you know, catering to cravings, which I think is fantastic. But doesn't that almost go against what you're trying to talk about when it comes to intuitive eating? Maybe you can define intuitive eating a little bit more.
Okay. Let me go back a little bit, because I'd like left dieting in the traditional sense, me personally, before I even became a health coach. But then I got into the wellness sort of space. Influence, not space, being influenced by wellness culture.
Oh, okay.
Where it wasn't about the weight loss, it was about being healthy and avoiding certain foods or eating in a certain way or a certain time. There was still weight involved because it's also linked to weight, where you need to be at a certain weight in order to be healthy. Or the slimmer you are, the healthier you are. You know, health equals like lower weight. So I was still influenced by that. But it was, you know, my mindset changed, shifted a bit. And at that time, I felt like I was not being honest or being genuine because I had the bakery that was selling desserts. But at the same time, I was like avoiding sugar, you know, and trying to cut it out. So I felt like I was being a hypocrite. But then, thankfully, once I, you know, wasn't in that trap anymore and sort of broke away and started to understand more about intuitive eating, then I like I'd made peace with all foods and I made peace with the fact that I have the bakery, because it's not just a dessert or sugar. There's way more to food in general, whether it is a dessert, even though now sugar is the villain at the moment. But it's celebration, it's sharing, it's, you know, zwara on the weekend, it's, you know, so your favorite dessert from a certain place. It's memories. It's memories. Like even now here, I'm in Dubai. I bring my usual, you know, gifts and snacks, and my friend who I've been bringing for her kids since they were like really young. So even to them, when they don't even live in Kuwait, it's connected to memories. Like, you know, oh, Khalti Arwa is coming to Dubai and she brought her snacks. You know, there's memories to it. And even like now I see people where it's memories of their kids' birthdays. So there's so much more attached to food. It's not just a nutrient. There's the context of how you're having it.
So does that mean you were completely immersed in diet culture, though, when it came to the way you looked at yourself and your own relationship to your body?
Yes, I was.
Why? I mean, you don't look it.
Because I wasn't in a small body, let's say, when I was a teenager.
Okay.
So I did go through that, like, weight loss attempts, that, you know, success and failure as... most people, you know, most people don't go on one diet and then that's it. Most people go on several diets. And I sort of was successful because I am now at a lower weight than when I was a teenager.
Wow.
Okay. But at the same time, we'll come back to it when I explain more about intuitive eating. I wasn't at my natural weight. Mm. So when I was a teenager, my behaviors or my eating habits put me at a higher weight than my natural weight.
Ah, okay.
Okay? I'm not going to say numbers because it's a bit triggering for some
people.
And
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter, exactly. So I went, so now I'm at my natural weight. But when I was like more seeped into diet culture and had like the behaviors that were putting me at a lower weight, lower than my natural weight. So now, even though I'm lower than my weight than I was when I was a teenager, it's because this is my natural weight. As a teenager, I was higher than my natural weight. But when I was doing all the restrictive behaviors, I was lower than my natural weight.
Yeah. I think also just to reference, when we talk about natural, we're talking about proportional to the body shape and type that you have.
It's not proportional. It's based on genetics mainly.
Okay.
With time, it is influenced by your behaviors. And the more dieting you do and the more time that passes, the higher your natural weight becomes. Or it's called the set point weight. It can be called like your biological weight. There's a lot of names for it. But it's the weight you would be if you were eating based on your physical needs and with movement involved. So you're not a sedentary, but you're not an athlete. There is movement. You're eating, you know, you're honoring your hunger, you're honoring your fullness, you're eating balanced meals. That's your natural weight, basically.
Yeah. I like how you use the term honoring your hunger, honoring your fullness.
Yeah.
Because again, that comes back to this idea of I'm also honoring my limits, myself, respecting my own body. And the reason I'm making it a point to kind of talk about this first is because when I think about my own experience and my own journey, I was always framed as someone who was naturally thin. Mm-hmm. Okay. I always had a smaller frame. And even when I was quite young, was always labeled as thin, which to a lot of my classmates, as an example, I didn't have problems to deal with. I was one of the late bloomers when it came to my female body. So a lot of the struggle started there because I always felt like there was something about me that didn't feel normal, even if what was defined as normal at that time was thin, because that was the aspiration. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about this idea of a voice in your head, I guess what I'm trying to get to is it starts incredibly early. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's something that almost grows and develops as you grow and develop, and almost interferes with how you evolve as your sense of self. So my question to you is, when did you start hearing this voice? What was it that triggered it? Was it just your physical, or was it something external?
For me, it was coming across people who were intuitive eaters by nature.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so there was education around it.
Yeah.
Okay. It,
no, but, you know, I didn't, at that time, intuitive eating either didn't exist or it still wasn't mainstream. So I didn't even know about it. Therefore, the first edition of the intuitive eating book, which is covers the 10 principles of intuitive eating, came out in 95. So that's actually when I started to notice certain things that were odd for me. One example was, you know, going to university and going for lunch with a friend, and she ordered apple pie with ice cream for lunch. And to me, it was just like, how can you eat dessert for lunch? Aren't you supposed to have food first? Because I had that rule. The rule is like, you don't have dessert as a meal. You have to have it after the meal. But then I realized that she doesn't have any rules. That's what she's in the mood for. That's what she's going to have. So it was like a light bulb moment for me. And then it was other people. And then my husband. When I got married, you know, you're someone you're with all the time. And he was an intuitive eater. And I actually struggled because it wasn't just about, you know, healthy or not healthy, or you know, higher calorie or lower calorie. It was about, you know, what do I want to eat now as opposed to what I'm supposed to eat, because it's the time to eat and we're in Italy and we have to have Italian food. But for him, it's no, I'm not in the mood for Italian food. I'm not hungry. I'm not going to eat. So it was something else. It was another way that shaped my experience. I was still in diet culture, but it was just those things that, you know, opened my eyes to a different way of eating.
But I think, look, to sum up, when it comes to intuitive eating, it comes back to this idea of being aware of what it is that your body needs and wants. So there's almost an acceptance and a kindness and some sort of a... What I'm trying to get to is that when we talk about the insecurities that we have with our bodies, we talked about this idea of a voice in our head that consistently tells us that we're not enough. Mm-hmm. And then you talk about intuitive eating. Intuitive eating is about being in touch with that voice and being a lot more forgiving and allow kind of yourself to not have those rules that were put in place not by you, but by someone else. So can you speak to this idea of where that internal voice comes from when you are struggling?
Mm-hmm. So let me just explain something about intuitive eating. So intuitive eating is a weight neutral framework that is specifically for people who have been dieting for a long time and it's not working and they need something to follow, because usually when you stop dieting, you don't know how to eat. You know, if you've been dieting for a long time, it's either you're following a diet and you're following the rules of the diet, or you're just, you know, ruining the diet. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the things you've been mentioned are like part of the principles, some of the principles. So you've got 10 principles. They're not rules. And the first principle is to reject the diet mentality. Because if you keep thinking that you're going to go on a diet, it's very hard to make peace with food. It's very hard to honor your hunger and respect your fullness, because there is restriction in the future. There's always this thought that I'm not going to be able to eat this food in the future, so you won't be able to eat it in a normal way. So there's this feeling of scarcity. But also one of the principles is called making peace with food. So when you make peace with food, it's being neutral, so not seeing it as good or bad, because that's when you can understand if you really enjoy it, if you really want it, if it's, you know, what you've had is enough. If you're demonizing it or putting it on a pedestal, you're not eating it because you're craving it, or you're not eating it because, you know, you, this is what your body needs. You're eating it because of those rules in your head. And then there's a principle that's to do with the voice, those rules either from your childhood or from going on so many diets. And that's voice is called the food police, okay? So it's those thoughts that judge either the way you look or the type of food you're eating or how much you're eating. And when you're listening to it, it's so loud that you are unable to connect with what you truly need or want, you know, whether it's a physical need or an emotional need, you know, in both ways. Sometimes we eat for emotional reasons. It's not always to, you know, I'm hungry and I'm going to eat this food and that's it. There's more to it. And when that voice is loud, it's so hard to connect to your body.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, I mean, that's part of the work I do with my clients, because everyone has different rules, different experiences. Some people, you know, didn't experience diet culture at home. It happened afterwards. So for some, it is the voice of their mom. Mm-hmm. It is the voice of their dad. And for others, no. It's the voice of the nutritionist they've been to, you know. So they need to, like, connect to where did that come from? You know, where is that rule from? Or where is this judgment about how their body looks? Where did that come from? And when we look into that, that's when we try to bring the healthy self that you mentioned. Mm. Okay, so answering back from the healthy self helps make the healthy self stronger. The stronger the healthy self becomes, the easier it is to not let the disordered self, let's say, take over or, you know, make the decisions for you.
Yeah. You know what's interesting about what you're saying? Immediately, I did make the connection that a lot of this talk, this voice, mm-hmm. starts from a young age and probably from the home that you lived in with your family. Because when you do live in a house with a family, there is a routine and a cycle that to an extent helps, you know, organize a child's day. So there are times when you eat and there's not always flexibility around the menu. But what's interesting is that as we get older, it's a super fast-paced world. We get into college, we start working, we start moving from, you know, a comfortable 2-hour seated lunch to a 20-minute on-the-go sandwich between meetings, mm-hmm. while you're also on Zoom, while you're sipping on something, because the priority is to make sure you get to the gym and hydrate with a protein shake and not, you know, make sure you get the right food in. So our lifestyle doesn't necessarily accommodate this idea of intuitive eating. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because when people think about eating disorders, they think of it in terms of extremes. They think of anorexia. They think of bulimia. But what I've come to learn, funny enough, from listening to a lot of your content, is that the danger of eating disorders is directly in the relationship you have with your food. Mm. One of the experiences that I had when I was burning out was that I would almost be disgusted when I was eating, because I used to feel guilty about, I'm doing this because I have to, I'm not chewing it properly, I'm swallowing quickly. And I didn't realize that this could potentially lead to a dangerous territory of becoming a disorder. And funny enough, when I started speaking about it and asking questions about it, especially when it came to my own friends and my own circle, they talked about the same thing, but they never viewed it as a problem. This is just You have a busy lifestyle. You're on the go. Mm. So I'd like to hear your thoughts around this idea of what is an eating disorder? What qualifies as one? And what are the signs of to kind of look out for?
Okay. Remind me, we're going to come back to that. But there's something you said about when you're busy. Mm. When you are eating intuitively, you are way more flexible. Mm. So you're fine with having the protein shake because that's the fastest thing that's going to get you through the day. Mm-hmm. But you're also fine with grabbing a sandwich because you don't have the rule of no carbs or no gluten or whatever it is. You know, you're fine with grabbing a sandwich that and not checking the calories on it. So there's more flexibility compared to someone who is busy but also has so many rules. And then they don't have the flexibility of feeding themselves and getting the enough nourishment to get through the day.
Okay, so interesting. Yeah. So really the mindset is about incorporating flexibility into your schedule and not having this rigidness. Which is weird because when I think about not just diet culture, when I think about even gym culture and just this idea of, you know, maintaining a specific type of activity throughout the day, a lot of the discipline that is encouraged revolves around this idea of a specific rigid routine. You eat at this time, you snack at this time, you eat at this versus what you're saying, which is to be a little bit more flexible, listen to your body. And accommodate that way.
Yeah, but if you're training for something or you're an athlete, you know, I can understand that you're putting a lot of time and effort into, you know, what you're eating in a day. But we're talking about, you know, someone who's busy because of work. They're an executive. They have their own, you know, business and kids and responsibilities. And they're trying to fit in also eating clean or eating healthy or, you know, getting enough protein in. It's too much. It's different when you know, you have enough time and energy to put into eating in a certain way for certain goals, even if they're aesthetic goals.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So, eating disorder. So how do you determine if someone has an eating disorder or not? First of all, when it comes to diagnosis, only psychiatrists or MDs, like doctors, are the only people that can diagnose.
A psychiatrist?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So even a therapist can't diagnose. Officially, only psychiatrists or doctors.
But
so
it's interesting MDs. That it's a head doctor, not a nutritionist or...
No, you can't.
Okay, interesting.
Diagnosis in general, whether it's a mental illness or something else, if it's a medical diagnosis, you need to be a doctor. But at the same time, when it comes to determining if someone has an eating disorder, you know, there's something called the DSM-5, which is the diagnostic criteria for mental illnesses. So it would have certain, let's say, criteria to be met in order to be diagnosed with any of the eating disorders. But there, you still always have exceptions. So someone might be diagnosed, or someone might not fit the diagnosis of anorexia because she's not at that low weight, but that's not her body type. She still has all the other malnutrition, loss of her period, loss of hair, you know, all the other aspects, the you know, going to a much lower weight than normal, but she's not at a weight that's considered, let's say, under 17 in the BMI. Okay. You know what I mean? So she won't be diagnosed with anorexia, but she has all the other symptoms. So it's not a matter of being diagnosed or not, it's how much is it affecting your life? Are you able to live a normal life? Mm. Has it taken over your life? That's really what's most important when you look at it. You know, is your relationship with food affecting your life in a way where you can't get through the day without doing the behaviors that are considered disordered? And at the same time, something that wouldn't be disordered for someone would be disordered for someone else.
What do you mean?
So certain behaviors can be considered disordered for certain personalities and for others it's not. So someone could be like intermittent fasting and avoiding, let's say, you know, sugar, and that doesn't affect their quality of life. They're living normally, they're getting by their day, they're not thinking about food all the time. And so that means it's not disordered for them, but for someone else, it would be taking over their life. Mm.
That being said, what role do you think that culture plays in shaping our relationship with food and our bodies, especially us Arabs?
I think we've been affected by Western culture.
You think?
Yeah. Mm. I don't think...
In what way?
Because what's considered healthy comes to us. What's considered, you know, let's say more beautiful comes to us. But I don't think it was there, you know, 150 years ago. Mm. There wasn't this focus on being in a certain shape or, you know, looking a certain way. Mm. I feel it comes from the West, and it's normal. It's not just for Arabs. It's the same thing in other parts of the world. There was a study done on the island of Fiji where there were zero eating disorders. And then, and I can't remember honestly what the year was, but it was like a time when there was like no TV. I think it was like in the 70s or something like that. And then like years later when TVs were introduced and they started seeing shows, you know, like American shows or whatever. And then that's when the eating disorders started to develop. And in Fiji, like the women were more voluptuous. But then that's when they started to develop because everyone they saw on screen was skinny.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I do with clients. And it really makes a huge difference because once they start following accounts where people are in different body shapes and sizes, their eye gets used to seeing different sizes. They start to like, you know, a different look. Because I used to say that. I love the skinny look. It's not that I, you know, I love it. That's what I like. No, I was conditioned to like it. Mm. I don't like it anymore.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm more neutral. I can like bigger, smaller. It doesn't matter. You know,
it's interesting because now, especially with the emergence of social media, diet culture and this aspirational body culture, you know, summer beach body or specific procedures to look a specific way, filters that are being used. What it's done is it's driven this, you know, I don't even know what to call it. It's not a sway in perspective. It's a complete distortion of perspective mm-hmm. in terms of how we see ourselves. But again, it starts from a place that stems from something internal that started in a family home. And I feel like so much of what you're referring to feels more psychological than nutritional.
Yes.
So why would someone work with an intuitive eating coach as opposed to a psychologist? What's the difference?
Because the psychologist might have her own issues with body image and eating.
Okay.
So you can't go to someone who's... Okay, let's give another example. Okay. I know it's not very much with our culture, but it's like the best example I can think of now. Let's say someone has an issue with alcohol, okay? But they go to a psychologist who drinks a lot of alcohol and actually wants to stop and is not able to stop. But they don't know that about them. But they might benefit more by going to a sober coach or a psychologist who actually, like, you know, has experience, either it's, you know, personal experience or training when it comes to like helping someone with their addiction to alcohol, you know? So when you're trained in what I've been trained, you're vetted. You know, you can't go through this unless you have a normal relationship with food. You know, you have a relatively good body image. Nothing is perfect, you know, but you've worked on yourself. Because it's very hard to help someone when you have your own issues.
100%. Yeah. But is that a caveat? Like, do you need to have also gone through the trauma or the experience of unhealthy body image or any sort of disorder to be able to qualify to do this kind of work?
I think there's pros and cons for both.
Okay.
Having personal experience is always helpful, for sure. But at the same time, you get influenced by your own personal experience and how you got through it, because then you find that the way you were able to recover is like the best way. So you become biased towards going a certain way or taking a certain amount of time. Well, I don't have that bias because I had my issues with food. I had a disordered relationship, but it was never to the extent of an eating disorder. So I'm not biased to needing to follow a certain way. And also there's never this doubt like, is she okay? Has she really recovered? Because, alhamdulillah, I was really, to be honest, like even when I say I had disordered relationship with food, I was lucky.
Alhamdulillah. How do you think shame shows up in the recovery process?
Honestly, shame, let's go back to, first of all, how it shows up when every time someone fails at going on a diet, at sticking to a diet, okay? I think, it starts there. Because every time, the thing is that they are ashamed for not sticking to the diet because it always comes back to willpower. And there's always some person who stuck with it or some before and after picture pops up on their Instagram to remind them that they didn't stick to it like this person in the after picture did. And every time they fail, the shame comes up. It even comes up before they fail. Because it's just this thought that they're so hungry or this thought of like, whatever food they really want to eat. And honestly, I feel like it sort of becomes more something like they're used to in that it gets triggered even more easily from other stuff. When it comes to recovery, again, there's always failure. You have to fail. It's so normal. None of my clients have had a straight
linear path.
Exactly.
Makes sense. It's interesting that you brought up the reference to the before and after examples. I see a lot of that when it comes to gym culture. And I always saw it as, the way that it's used on social media is it's used as almost, again, clickbait for what you should aspire for, physical change. And what's interesting, the way that you talk about intuitive eating and the way that you market it has less to do about how you look and more to do about how you feel and how you show up in life. Exactly. So it's really about mindset. You've said before that recovery isn't just about stopping behavior. It's about integration. What does that look like in real life? What does it mean to integrate intuitive eating into my life?
Okay, so let's go back to stopping behavior, okay? So when you're recovering, whether it's an active diagnosable eating disorder or it's a disordered relationship with food, usually there's certain behaviors that need to change. Either they need to stop certain behaviors or adapt new behaviors. And then there's the change in the way you think, okay? So sometimes like the behaviors change, but it's still the way that you're thinking that needs more time, especially that behaviors, let's say, are more physical, while the way you think is more like rewiring of your brain, and that needs more time for the rewiring to happen. So what happens is that once they get to that point where the behaviors are changed, the thinking is almost, very little diet culture, unless they've been triggered, like, seeing a before and after picture, or some friend or colleague at work mentioning this new diet they're on. Most of the time, it's not on their mind. But then they start to see other aspects of their life being influenced. For example, they're more likely to put boundaries while they didn't in the past. So because this respect for your body and not feeding it in a way that would harm it or starving it in a way that would harm it, either way, puts you in a place where you want more balance in your life in general, because it's hard to say, I need more balance in my life when the basic thing of feeding yourself is not being met. So once that is, let's say, secured and you feel you're grounded in it, there's more space for you to really listen to what your intuition wants, as opposed to not just eating, but in life.
Interesting. And is that part of the process? You work with people to get to a stage where they're able to incorporate these types of, one, get this kind of confidence in themselves, having more respect for their body, but also drawing boundaries in their lives?
It depends. It depends on where it's... So, for example, let's say if it's a client where this setting up boundaries is needed for her in order to start applying the intuitive eating principles.
Okay.
You know, she's the type of person who's always there for everybody else.
Doesn't know how to say no.
Exactly. Doesn't know how to say no. And that's standing in the way of her, you know, going to the gym or sleeping early enough or, you know, preparing the meal that she really wants to eat. So she needs to set those boundaries early because it's standing in the way of her applying the principles.
Fair. What have you found gets most in the way of healing?
It's the first principle, which is reject the diet mentality. Because, you know, it's this feeling that, yeah, but I'm going to go back to dieting later. You know what I mean? That usually stands in the way. And the other thing is when someone is in a bigger body. So when someone's in a larger body, the pressure isn't just from them, it's from the outside too.
Meaning people?
Meaning other people.
Okay.
Sometimes, you know, it's their family members.
Yeah.
You know, I've had clients where, you know, the family is pressuring them to do bariatric surgery, like extreme, not just even go on a diet. And they don't want to. Or they, you know, they keep getting pressured into like, yeah, but try this or do that or, you know, and they're trying to work on themselves. And this is coming from the outside. It's very hard. But when someone is like in a, let's say they're closer to a weight that's acceptable in our society, then it's more internal pressure. So it's more they're working on themselves, not very little from outside.
You work with women who want to stop punishing themselves with food.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to someone who feels like they can't stop even when they want to?
Usually I'd like give them an example of something that would show them that they can't stop. Like, you know, if I was going to give you 1,000 kd, would you stop? Or, you know.
So it's about understanding what their limit is?
No, it's about understanding there is a part of them that can stop. There's always a part that can stop. Mm. It's just that it's not that strong. We need to make it stronger.
But the thing is, what you're saying, I understand if someone who is self-aware enough, who's going to find that willpower by actively going and seeking a coach.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're talking about people who are truly struggling, who feel like their environment doesn't support their healing, I mean, how do you make a case to get these people to change? Because, or is it just you have to have that level of awareness where you want to change?
It's okay not to want to change. In the end, it's everyone is free to do what they want. If someone wants to, you know, continue to restrict in order to be at a lower weight, even though she knows that it's affecting her quality of life, even though she knows it's affecting her health, she's making a conscious decision. She's an adult. You know what I mean? It's just like someone who decides, I'm not going to quit smoking.
Mm.
They know it's bad for their health. They just don't want to.
And they've accepted it.
They've accepted it. Exactly. So in the end, everyone is free to make their own decisions. But sometimes there's that part of them that wants to get better. And they would reach out. And then they'd reach out, let's say, and sign up with me. And it's normal to not change their mind, but that other part of them that doesn't want to get better and doesn't want to do the work will show up. And I just need to remind them of that part that reached out to me and signed up with me. And we just keep working on that. And then that part gets stronger.
We keep referring to women, which is, I think, is a little bit unfair and misleading. But yes. Like, how about men in this space? Do you get a lot of men that struggle with this and are willing to make that change?
Honestly, they're less for sure, because they're usually not aware. It's the same thing with women. It's so normalized. You know, if I list all the behaviors that are considered disordered, they are actually considered good. They're considered healthy. Like, you're considered someone who's really disciplined because you do these behaviors. Mm. So whether it's men or women. But again, it's also some men are not affected as others. So I have male clients, and it's always, I'm always like surprised or astonished that they had that self-awareness to realize that they have a problem and they need help with it.
And courage.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it takes a lot of courage to take that first step.
That's true.
It's one thing to be educated. It's another thing to take action on the education or the knowledge that you have. So I commend anyone that wants to.
100%.
How has becoming a coach in this space, or not even a coach, how has becoming an intuitive eater mm-hmm. affected the dynamic of the relationships within your life? As a mother, mm-hmm. as a wife, mm-hmm. as a daughter, as a sibling, sister, brothers or sisters?
I don't know. I hope I'm a better person. I hope I'm more fun to be around. I'm definitely way more flexible. I find it's probably, when it comes to my family, probably when we travel, I'm way easier. You know, I'm like, order whatever you want. I'll just eat whatever is there. And thankfully, I changed at a time when my kids were at an age where I didn't screw them up. My younger daughter wasn't affected at all because she was much younger, but my older one was a bit. And she loves teasing me about it. But thankfully, when that time came and she wanted to go on a diet, I helped her to see that she won't like it. But I let her try and she realized on her own, and that was the last of it. Other relationships, honestly, I don't know. Other than like at home, I don't think it made a huge difference because I'm the one who was doing the dieting. They weren't. So I just like became more myself, Okay, let me go back, actually. Because most of my dieting was like on my own. Like it wouldn't really affect going out with friends or you know, being with family. I would eat relatively normally, except when I'm doing like some detox and not eat at all.
Actually, I can attest to a different behavior as your friend.
Oh, really?
I feel like a large part of what I like about you is the boundaries that you set for yourself in the way that you manage your time. You're very conscious about the way that you like to start your morning, mm-hmm. when you like to eat, mm-hmm. what you like to eat. You don't have rules around what to eat, but you're very kind of open to trying things, but you're very adamant on, for me to be the best version of myself, mm-hmm. this is a routine that I like to follow. As an example, you didn't want to go out until, you know, you like to have, your morning routine, mm-hmm. which is beautiful. It's beautiful that you were able to assert yourself in a way that didn't take away from the experience of sharing time with you as a friend. And what's interesting about that is just that as a mindset invites others to think about how they're showing up in their own lives. But what's interesting about you, Arwa, is that you really are living the principles that you're talking about, which is funny because I think that's why you aren't looking at it as a way that you're marketing it. You don't see it as a way that you're marketing intuitive eating because you're actually living it. I think this is what intuitive eating ideally looks like. It's taking away the shame of having to have rules around how I have to be, encouraging yourself to listen to yourself. And that's really powerful. Mm-hmm.
But it would look different for everybody. That's the thing. So my way of intuitive eating is not going to be the same as someone else's intuitive eating.
100%.
Yeah, 100%. That's what's beautiful about it. Because, you know, you go to, even if it's, like a dietitian or nutritionist that would cater to someone's, you know, different lifestyle, but it's still going to be very similar to someone else's clean eating or dieting. But when it comes to intuitive eating, it's totally based on your lifestyle, your likes, your dislikes, your personality, your circumstances. You change it based on that. Nobody knows about that more than you.
What would you say to someone who's listening right now, who's still in the middle of it, who doesn't believe that they can get better and doesn't really know how to start, where to start?
They need to educate themselves because do they really know, or is this the first time they hear about it? You know, there are actually like tests you can do online to understand. They can just contact me. I can send them like the test online, you know, in the DMs.
I'll link it also in that episode. Yeah. But I think, look, with the emergence of lifestyle coaches, And of course, this is not to take away from any coaches, all the respect to all of them. But I feel like with the emergence of so many different certifications to becoming a coach, it's very easy for one to get lost mm-hmm. in, like, for example, I didn't realize how much insight from a mental perspective, almost like the conversations I would have with a therapist, would happen with an intuitive eating coach mm-hmm. because we're talking about where thoughts and belief systems stem from. Mm-hmm. So I think it's easy for someone to get lost in this space. So are there any kind of key indicators or red flags that you would caution people against?
You mean if they're going to be working with a coach or
if they have a problem, but they don't know how to deal with it? Because going and looking for a coach is not easy. And especially if you don't know you have a problem yet and you're just going to a therapist or going to a lifestyle coach and they're mm-hmm. just saying, no, I mean, you look fine. You don't have an eating disorder. You're fine.
Yeah, that's true. If they don't have the background or the training in eating disorders, they might dismiss, you know, how they feel.
So how can I, let's say I'm someone who's struggling. Mm-hmm. I'm struggling with my belief system about my body and my relationship to food is incredibly toxic and unhealthy. But I mean, I'm alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get sick every once in a while. I get a cold every once in a while. But like, you know, there has to be something that should be a red flag for me of, no, Dana, this is serious. Go get checked.
It's how much energy and time does it take from your day or from your life?
In terms of eating or thinking about eating?
Everything. So physical effort, mental space, emotional wellness, how much time does it take? Because does it take, you know, a normal amount of time? Does it allow you to do everything else, you know, you want to do? Whether when it comes to like your work, your relationships, self-care, having fun, you know, is it taking up too much space where all those other aspects or certain parts of them are being neglected? Then it needs to be addressed.
Okay, so that's the major red flag.
Yeah, and as a coach, you're trained to know what to work with and what needs to be taken care of with either a psychiatrist or a therapist.
So you would actually guide and refer?
It depends.
Okay.
So I'm trained to work on the how, not the why. So I don't deal with why you have the eating disorder. I deal with how we can change the behaviors and change the thinking pattern in order to recover. The day-to-day changes that need to be made.
And does one need to understand the why in order to move into recovery?
Not at the beginning. Because sometimes you would waste time trying to figure out the why and your health is being compromised while you're trying to figure out the why. And you need to get better physically. And when you get better physically, you're mentally able to figure out the why. And again, you might not figure out the why because sometimes there was no why. Sometimes it was just literally being in a state of malnutrition that created the mental difficulties. And once you fix the malnutrition, the mental issues would go away.
You're talking about the nutritional issues affect the imbalance or the balance of specific hormones or things like that? What do you mean?
It depends on the type of eating disorder, but let's say if it's anorexia, they're not eating enough. So it's as if their body's starving.
Wow. What would you say to a younger version of yourself who believed that being smaller or fitting that aspirational Instagram look would make life better?
Oh, it's not worth it. Oh my God, there's so much you can do with your life if you put that time and effort and money into something else. Really, so much time wasted. Like when I have clients that are teenagers, and usually they're just such smart kids, so talented. And I'd be like, wow, you know when you recover, رحت كسرين الدنيا. Like, you know, wow, like the world needs to be ready for you because you're going to be amazing. Because see, like they'd be like excellent at school and extracurricular activities, and they have an eating disorder and they're a teenager. So imagine how much they're going to accomplish once they've got that out of their life. So yeah, tell her don't waste time.
What about forgiveness and this idea of being a lot more compassionate and forgiving to yourself? Do you find that this is something that shows up in recovery?
Yes, it's a big part of it. Because so many people feel that if I was hard on myself, then I'm more likely to change. But it's the opposite. I'm not saying, you know, being hard on yourself won't get you going, but it's like the carrot or the stick. You know, the carrot can get the donkey to move, and now the stick can get the donkey to move. But if they're it's moving anyway, isn't the carrot better than the stick? So if you're being kind to yourself, you can still get the change you want, but without putting yourself down. And for sure, it's better long term. Because the stick, after a certain time, doesn't really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Arwa.
You're welcome.
I usually end episodes on a final question.
Yeah.
One that I ask all my guests. Mm-hmm. What would you want to ask me? Based on the conversation that we had today, what would you want me to consider?
So I would like you to consider, you and someone listening, how much time have they wasted?
We. I've wasted so much time.
How much more time are you willing to waste?
Yeah.
And if you put it in something else, what would it be? And what would you be able to achieve?
You know what's crazy? I recently came across pictures of myself from mm-hmm. college. Mm-hmm. Okay. And like I said, I was a late bloomer. So I came into kind of all the aspects of my body and my sense of self in my early 20s, I would say. And it's so crazy because I remember how I used to feel back then. Like, it's very distinctive. I remember the self-talk. I remember how I used to feel about myself. And I remember what I would wear that would reflect really how I would feel about myself, in all honesty. What's so interesting is that when I look at that person now, I look at her and she is so incredibly beautiful.
Oh,
that version of Dana is beautiful. Mm. How could I have thought and felt those cruel things back then? And why? I spent so much time thinking about all the things that I didn't have. And I was still young. I mean, yeah. I'm still at the beginning. Our entire 20s are kind of the peak of our development, especially as women, as we continue to evolve. But like, I was looking at that picture. It was a video actually. And I was just so amazed at one, how far I've come, but also how I was more than enough back then.
Yes.
And I think it's such an important thing to reflect on and look at just as an exercise, you know, and I make it a point to do that at least once a year on my birthday. I take a look at those older photos of Dana and I remember how I felt back then. And I think about what the version of me now would want to have said to that little girl.
Oh.
And it's been a game-changing exercise. So,
and maybe what your future self in 20 years or 30 years would think about you now.
Yeah.
She'd probably be very proud of you now.
Yeah.
So, works both ways.
100%. That in itself is an encouraging feeling.
Yes.
Thank you. So thank you for that, Arwa.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate you taking the time to be here. I know this was a last-minute booking, so I appreciate you making the time.
I enjoyed it. This is fun.
I'm glad. I'm so glad. And to all our listeners, I want to thank you for the privilege of your time, as always. I hope you were able to benefit from the insights that were shared today on intuitive eating. I'll be sure to link all of the documents and resources that Arwa referred to today. Oh, one thing I did forget to ask. Arwa, if someone was interested in contacting you and understanding more about what you do, what are the best ways to contact you?
To contact me, I think the best way would be on my Instagram.
Okay.
To like dive into some of the topics we talked about today, they can go to my YouTube because that's when the longer version videos are.
And the resources.
Yes.
Okay, cool. And do you accommodate both English and Arabic clients, Arabic-speaking clients?
So definitely. I work with clients, whether it's English or Arabic. And on my website, all the content is also in both languages.
Awesome. So yeah, there it is. I'll make sure to link up all the resources. Make sure you subscribe to the channel that you are watching or listening to this episode on. In the meantime, I hope you found something to consider.